What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering. bellacatering.com.au is where you can find the best catering in Sydney as we're starting to open up from COVID-19. The incredible guys who've been doing it really tough, Bella Catering, are still there. They're still humming along. Get involved. If you now are starting to allow to have a lot of people at your house, why not have it catered? Delicious food, delicious Greek-made food, delicious Italian food, all sorts of cuisine. Unbelievable people. Glenn and Maria, we love them. And they've been so great to their great cohort of folk that they work with. And we've just been really proud that they've been to give them a shout out and as the naming sponsor of this show. Thank you so much for listening to All the President's Minutes. Thank you so much for supporting Bella Catering. It's bellacatering.com.au. Now, as always, let's do this thing.
I want to thank you for letting me be on this, be part of this conversation. Let me be clear. The president just used a Bible, the most sacred text of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and one of the churches of my diocese, without permission, as a backdrop for a message antithetical to the teachings of Jesus and everything that our churches stand for. And to do so, as you just said, he sanctioned the use of tear gas by police officers in riot gear to clear the church guard. I am outraged. The president did not pray when he came to St. John's, nor, as you just articulated, did he acknowledge the agony of our country right now, and in particular that of the people of color in our nation, who wonder if anyone in public power will ever acknowledge their sacred worth, and who are rightfully demanding an end to 400 years of systemic racism and white supremacy in our country. And I just want the world to know that we in the Diocese of Washington, following Jesus and his way of love, distance ourselves from the incendiary language of this president. We follow someone who lived a life of nonviolence and sacrificial love. We align ourselves with those seeking justice for the death of George Floyd and countless others through the sacred act of peaceful protest. And I just can't believe what my eyes have seen tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is a friend, an editor and a writer that I really admire, and the founder, the engine, the perpetual movement machine inside Vague Visages, also senior writer at Screen Rant, and a contributor to, you know, I think if you can be in the peer group of RogerEbert.com or Ebert Voices, as they call themselves occasionally, I think that is a very special cohort to be a member of. But he's just a great film mind, and he continues, for whatever reason, to allow me to write for his drastically awesome publication turned film social media site, Vague Visages. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my distinct pleasure again to chat to my friend, QV Haug. QV, how are you, my friend?
Blake, thank you so much for having me. I like to envision like all the president's minutes, like a vision board or like an obsession wall. And I got my name up there with all these great guests. It's really an honor. Thank you so much.
That's you talk about, that's like when people see the garage open in True Detective and you see Rustin Cole, played by Matthew McConaughey, walk in and there's just this creepy corkboard that has things like Yellow King and Carcosa and pictures, and Woody Harrelson as the audience, I feel in that moment, is like, oh my God, this guy's crazy. He's lost it. That's kind of my dream. Like I will look in that garage of a wall of like chaos and inspiration, and I'm like, and following leads, and I'm just like, holy dooly. These are my kindred spirits.
You know, Blake, it's the same for me with here in my one bedroom in Fargo running my site. It's just like a beautiful chaos, you know. It somehow comes together in the end, and I admire what you do, so thanks again.
You're welcome, my friend. And look, congratulations for folks. If you haven't stumbled upon my work in Vague Visages, you should just go check out the site. It is now a subscription site, but it really does, for exceptionally reasonable prices, have some of the best voices in film criticism around the world that are contributing, and it's a growing entity. And right now, more than ever, for the small couple of bucks that you can subscribe to the mag, it's giving you a lot of bang for your buck, including some of the great guests who've actually been on this show contribute to Vague Visages as well, which is cool. And occasionally I get to come on there and talk about the apocalypse or mental health in movies and do some other cool stuff. So that's very fun for me.
Yeah, I'd love to have you more on the site in the future. You know, I just started the subscription on May 5th, was actually my 40th birthday.
Well, and happy birthday. May 1st was my 35th birthday. So we are Taurians together.
Hey, happy birthday, boy.
Happy belated birthday to you,
I'm a little bit old. I feel 35. I feel maybe 30. But I've been running Vogue from home for the last since I was about 35, 34. And on May 5th, my birthday, I kicked off the subscription. And so far, it's been a good start. And moving forward, you know, I think we're in a good spot right now where we can progressively build a budget, pay the writers more, and just keep the site moving forward and hopefully work with more people like yourself. So I'm excited.
Exciting times. And and it's awesome. You know, I'm really lucky. I know kind of a couple of I know a couple of people who run publications, yourself and Garth Franklin, pretty well, and I'm always amazed by your boundless fervor and your capacity to just have output, coordinate things. It's pretty incredible. So it's really cool to have you on. And if you just look up QV, you can find him on Twitter at QV Haug. We don't usually talk at that at the top of the show, but if you're listening, you want to check out the man I'm talking to whilst we're getting into this episode, that's where you can find him. In amongst all the other links that you'll have off to his work. But right now, you and I are staring at Robert Redford right on the precipice.
He's right there.
He's right here.
He's right there.
In a split diopter shot, he's staring down at a phone and he's staring daggers at a telephone in this the 51st minute. It is a great, it's kind of, I think people sometimes, and I know that I do it, like when I remember movies that I'm less familiar with, you imagine these two wonderful, epic conversations that happen with Redford following down rabbit holes of leads and people. And I think in your imagination, a lot of the time, you merge them together. So there's the early conversation where he's just drumming up bits and pieces of information. And then there's this sort of seminal one that just is a chaotic, beautiful conversation where it's got McGregor and Dahlberg and the weird and wonderful roller coaster that is the conversation as it's unfolding. And then this beautiful sort of chaos and debris of the newsroom, the rest of the chaos that's going on around him that just couldn't care less what he's doing. But all the drama and the focus of this great minute and the way that it's constructed with Mr. Pakula and Willis and obviously Redford himself is like, we are going to hold you. We're going to be engaged on you. These are going to be single takes. You're going to give us everything you got for however long it's going to take to nail it. And so it's such a... You know, both of these scenes I relish to talk about because I feel like even when you get done talking about them, there's just so much more. So before we dive into that together and this minute, and I know that you're very prepared as you always are, what's your relationship with the paranoia thriller and with and particularly with All the President's Men?
Well, you know, I grew up in the mid-90s. I was born in the 80s, so around 14, I started really getting into maybe my first wave of fandom, movie fandom. And at the time, my parents were divorced. My mother had moved. My sister had gone to college. My brother had also gone to the service and come back. So here's me, kind of by myself in a way. Not by myself, but as far as a movie fan, compared to my friends who were more, we're all into sports, we're all into movies, but for me, it was a little bit more intense. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so at 14, 15, I'm going to the VHS store. I'm grabbing anything I can. I'm going to visit my mom in Fargo, where I live now. At the time, I lived in small town Minnesota, about a half hour away. And so it was 5 for $5 for $5. It was illegal, R-rated movie rentals. And when that, in the early 90s, in terms of psychological thrillers, and this might not be a traditional psychological thriller, but there's a movie called Juice by Ernest Dickerson. Yeah. And it was starring Tupac Shakur.
I was going to say, does that have Tupac in it? Yeah, I'm vaguely familiar because I was right in that independent Hollywood, you know, I was in the quagmire.
Yeah, and it just got me. It's an action movie slash drama slash thriller, but it was something I hadn't experienced before as this white kid from small town Minnesota. And that was 91, 92, before I knew about Tupac as a musician. I'd say by the mid 90s is when I got more intense with renting movies, and I saw Seven for the first time, which was maybe 90, 95.
Yeah.
Later on in college, Spy Game with Redford and Brad Pitt. I was probably 21 then, but as far as All the President's Men, I can't remember, to be honest, the first time I saw it. I want to say I was 15 to 18, but I remember not quite being sure what was going on.
Yeah.
A
totally relatable experience for a 15 to 18 year old of like, I'm not. You know, 100% sure what's going on with this.
And I went on to study history and communication. So, you know, 25 years later, it's right up my alley. And there's still, now I can, like yourself, now I can look through each minute and find something. And when I look at it now as a 40-year-old in 2020, I just see, I'm stunned by, it's like the absence of information and all this looming power. Of course, there's Nixon, and the movie revolves around Nixon, but it's these other threats that are right there. And compared to 2020 culture with Trump, you know, Trump is, he's obviously the... A
couple of times people on the show have referred to him as Nixon squared, which I enjoy as a strange mathematical phrasing of that.
Nixon square.
Yeah.
But I think with Trump, you know, now it's like he's blatantly trolling. You know, you go back to Watergate and there's Nixon, but then there's all these other people and Hoffman and Bernstein and Woodward. You know, it's just, what I like about how the movie begins is that you don't see those two together for a few minutes. Correct me if I'm wrong, but
yeah, it's
they
about,
don't have their.
It's about 10 minutes. About 10 minutes. They don't, yeah, they're not really interacting with one another. Yeah.
And I think that's what turned me off as a teenager. I didn't get the big movie star moment. You know, think of it like this, you know, let's say I'm a 15-year-old and you're inviting me onto your podcast. I'm your cousin Quinn, you know, and you're, I'm a big movie fan. This is going to come up in the minute discussion later, but I'll bring it up now. You know, as a 15-year-old, I would just look for the movie stars. Redford, Hoffman, things I could identify with. And now there's just so many little details from minute to minute. And yeah, let's get into it.
All right, well, let's do this thing. We are going to watch the 51st minute of Alan J. Pakula's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. For folks who have followed this show along, I haven't done this sort of like disclaimer message as much, but I'll just do it again. Basically, every single version of All the President's Men should be the same. So if you're watching this on VOD or Blu-ray, or I believe there's some like some folks you can get like a special Warner archive access so you can watch it, and it's like basically the untampered with credits. The only difference between the theatrical cut and the Blu-ray, what I understand, is the Warner logo. So for example, you know, we talk about on this show, I think, way too much because of their intersecting qualities. But, you know, in Zodiac, Fincher, you know, made the point, just like Ben Affleck did with Argo and other things, to have the 70s logo. So if you're watching it, a very, very... If you have a reel-to-reel and you're screening this for yourself in your house, the only difference technically should be that. So right, if you go to 50 minutes on the dial, if you watch that now with QV and I, we're going to watch this minute together, this great sort of bit of journalistic agony and relationship building together. And we're going to come back and talk about it.
Could I please speak to Mr. Clark McGregor?
One moment, I'll connect
you. Thank you.
Yes?
Mr. McGregor.
Yes?
This is Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. Hello?
Yes?
This is Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. I just spoke to a Mr. Kenneth Dahlberg, who says that he is Midwest finance chief.
Yeah, I know Ken Dahlberg.
Well, I can't seem to get an explanation on why a check for $25,000 made out to Mr. Dahlberg that he apparently sent to the committee to re-elect the president would end up in the bank account of a Watergate burglar.
I don't know.
I don't know why a $25,000 check from Mr. Ken Dahlberg has gone into a bank account of a Watergate burglar. What a great question. What a great framing of a question. It is like loaded like a weapon. Great little minute.
And notice how Redford speaks as Woodward. You notice that upspeak in his tone?
Yes.
What's the question he says to him? I'm from the Washington Post. Like, I'm Ron Burgundy. You know, he's not quite authoritative with his phone call, or, you know, the traditional newsroom journalist. You know, tell me what you know. You know, he's not quite sure. The second time around, he's a little more comfortable asking the question, but I think that, you know, that speaks to Goldsman's script and perhaps working with Redford. And maybe, I don't know how that turned out when they're actually filming, but it's a nice little nugget for me as to how Redford reacts to his that phone call.
It's really good because the run up to the question, you don't know if it's going to be as good as it is. Like you said, there's a hesitation in his voice. He's like, oh, you know, this is Bob Woodward from the Washington Post. It's kind of like very rote and it's not confident. But when he gets McGregor on the phone, it's this beautiful, like, I don't know, I want to use the word languid, like the way that he delivers it. It's like, can you explain to me? It's the impossible to not answer question. It's like, you know, Mr. Dahlberg, yes, I do. Can you explain to me? I'm going to give you every out here, basically. Can you explain to me how the $25,000 from Mr. Dahlberg got into the bank account of a Watergate burglar? And so then that person has to lie or essentially perjure themselves on the phone to him. But I just love this minute, particularly QV, which is why I was so excited to talk to you about it, is I love silence when you can, and people's, and particularly great actors' ability to convey complex emotions and desires in just, you know, he's staring at an inanimate object. He's staring at a telephone. There's a humdrum of an office. And he's taking this emotional run-up to, like, okay, I've got to make this call, and I've got to skewer someone with this information. Like, I have to get this down. I have to get someone on the record about this. And I think what leads up to and what the sort of arc of this whole conversation is that really, you know, that the formulation of that question to, like, get that, to make McGregor in that moment be culpable for his answer is, I think, is just such a beautiful, it's like you said, it's a beautiful turn of phrase with the script. It's a beautiful use of Redford as an actor. It's terrific.
What I love now, you know, 25 years ago, I would have looked and saw the close-up on Redford. I would have saw his wedding ring, like, oh, there's a movie star. The character's married. he's not quite sure what he's doing. You know, earlier in the film, you know, he doesn't even know who, I can't remember the character, but he doesn't know who, like, one of Nixon's main guys is.
He doesn't know who Charles Colson is, the special advisor to the president. No, he doesn't know who Charles Colson is.
It's what's so beautiful to me about this shot visually is that the biggest statement, I would argue, is that, I shouldn't say the biggest statement, but what really is poignant about this shot is that the way Willis slowly zooms in into Redford's psyche as Woodward. This goes back to 2 minutes before when the scene starts. You know, there's the wide shot. And this is the recurring theme in the film where foreground, background. It goes to the final shot, which is probably my favorite shot of the film, with Nixon on the small left, and then Bernstein, Woodward, TV in the way, columns in the middle. Like, to me, that's just like visual symmetry. Like, I love that stuff.
Yes.
When I look at this minute, you know, just the frame compressed. I mean, you can interpret this a variety of ways depending on how you approach the film. You know. You can see Redford, the movie star. You can see what he's bringing visually, his mannerisms. You know, to me, like, Redford, the character, Woodward reminds me of my father. Like, I can't quite gauge what he's thinking when I talk to him. He's already thinking about the next question. He's not necessarily listening to everything that I'm saying, but he's taking notes, you know. On the other side of the screen, you know, there's all this other stuff going on behind Woodward's back, but visually, you know, there's these columns.
You brought up a great point. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to say that one thing that Gordon Willis hates, and is on the record hating, is zooming in mid-scene. He hates it.
Really? I didn't know that.
He's not a fan of it at all. And so when he's doing it, he's usually doing it in collaboration, or because the filmmaker that he's making it with is seeing the scene like that. So this glacial zoom, because in his mind, it is a distracting thing. It's something that can distract from what, you know, the zoom is like is a way to take you out of it. So what I love about this scene is that it is a glacial. It is not only just a really subtle and glacial zoom and reframing, it is also the body language of Redford sitting back in the chair, keeping the pace. And then when he moves in and leans forward, and like, we're talking together, so Cupid can see what I'm doing. But he's like, leans in. When he leans in and closes the distance between us and, you know, Woodward and us, and, you know, or the audience, as he's sort of going closer to that fourth wall, there is then that very, very minor adjustment that brings you into that closeness. And so it's one of those rare scenes of the movie where a zoom happens mid-frame, because everything is orchestrated to perfection. And usually, like you said, the symmetry of the scenes are so important, but this scene is just that very calculated thing. That very, you know, there is a personality, and there is the walls are closing in, and this is such a critical moment, and the focus on Woodward becomes paramount. It's like the movie puts blinkers on just for a second and says, hey, you really need to be paying attention right now.
Exactly. And you might not notice it the first time. You know, this is why rewatches are.
Yeah, I was going to say, rewatches are so important. You never, like, it's imperceptible the first, at least few times, I think.
You go back 2 minutes, there's this complete wide shot.
Yeah.
And it's just Redford. And then all of a sudden, like, it's just his face. And he's, in my minute, he says, his last line is, but you were the head of the committee, sir. And spilling over into the next minute, what does he say? You know, sir, we don't have a relationship. And here's this close-up on him. He's seconds earlier. He's not quite, he's a little hesitant, but within.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
In this short amount of time, you know, he's connected the dots. And what I like about Woodward, or Redford's portrayal of Woodward, is that he's not as showy as Hoffman's Bernstein. You know, Hoffman's kind of gliding around the newsroom and kind of knowing that people are looking at him, and he's got his hairdo and his really rather tight jeans, and just kind of, I mean, it's the '70s, I know, I get it. Woodward reminds me of someone kind of from my neck of the woods, where it's, they're not always easy to read. You know, he's maybe, as evidenced earlier in the film, he's not exactly, you know, he's not up to speed with who everyone is, all the main players, but he's figuring it out, you know, and,
yeah, he's hungry.
He's hungry.
And I think that's an observation that, you know, you can tell that kind of, that true Midwest ethos of, like, not easy to read, not hyper emotional, but I think it's also a huge bit of, I don't know how to describe it sometimes, like, or how to articulate it often, but it's like a huge gutsy thing for Redford to kind of, like, when you really know what your talent is, and to have a filmmaker really groom that talent for you, like in Willis and then obviously Pecula. Because
Recently, yeah, Jason Bailey on from Crooked Marquee, and he made a good observation about Redford just thinking Redford. And I don't know if that's what you're referring to.
Yeah,
but this is a great moment.
Yeah, this is thinking Redford, but it's also, you know, I think that that's his whole strength. It's like, how do I show that I can hold my own? If I'm this classic movie matinee idol, beautiful man, how can I hold my own in a world of Dustin Hoffmans and Gene Hackmans and Al Pacinos and Robert De Niro's? And how he holds his own is inversion. Like, it's just stillness and thinking. And he so trusts Pacula here to just take, like, this scene is just all about how I can stare at a phone and think things, or, you know, conjure up questions that may or may not be great. And Jason was spot on with it, and I think you're spot on with it. I just love your Midwestern actual experience sort of shining through of, like, these guys and their generations and the generations who are above them. They're not guys who are easy to read. And so in that way, so much of Woodward is that sort of Midwestern throwback, that kind of cowboy energy. But he comes in here and it's, despite the lack of experience, it's the directness that we crave from him, and being able to be direct but cordial. And he's very good at extracting information, I think, with those two elements. But it's fun how you say he reminds you of your dad. I don't know what this guy's thinking.
And there's even something about the pencil that he's holding, because for years, my father would wear a pencil in his ear. He's a contractor. He builds homes. And that was just his thing. Like, people would know that my dad wore a pencil in his ear. Here, Redford is holding the pencil. he's careful with what he's saying. He's not quite sure how he's saying it. And for me, that's just, and the character is, or Woodward is from Kansas, right? I believe that's where he's from. So it's total Midwestern as I watch this as a native Minnesotan. You know, that's my observation on with Bernstein. I'm not sure. Do you know where Bernstein grew up? Is he an East Coast guy? Or?
Yeah, he's East Coast. He's been working in newsrooms since he was 16. I think he's Washington through and through, like where he's from. And yeah, obviously Hoffman is a quintessentially sort of East Coast guy.
Hoffman's got a little more flavor with how he moves around the newsroom. And yeah, I love the scene earlier where he notices Redford's copy, Woodward's copy, and he grabs it and he fixes it. I can't quite tell if he knows that Woodward is watching him. He does it. He takes and the builds to the great Woodward line. You know, it's not
it's not what you did.
How did he say it? I don't.
It's not what you did. It's how you did it.
Yeah. So what do you think as an Australian? Like, what's your interpretation of these characters? Like, at least in these first 50 minutes, and especially this particular scene.
My thought of both of them is that they're sort of incomplete without one another. And it's less about, I think some people talk about it in terms of like, oh, they needed each other to learn. But it's like when you work really closely with people that you admire and they have qualities that you wish you had, you kind of steal them, not steal them in a bad way. You kind of absorb them. You're like, oh, that's really good.
Right.
Like, that's really good how that person does that. I like that. I'm going to try and see if I can put that into my arsenal. And so I think that what's starting to happen, and this is like the real gestation of it in this movie, is these guys have started to be around each other enough that some of those qualities, like Woodward's earlier qualities, are all about very casually, deliberately asking nice questions and sort of extracting information slowly, but he doesn't ever really, up to this point in the film, go for the jugular. And what I love here is we now start to see Woodward go for the jugular, whereas we kind of expect Carl to completely blunder in and go for the jugular without any finesse. It's cool here to watch that. And so that's what I start seeing in these two. So Bernstein, the real Carl Bernstein, born and raised in Washington, D.C., University of Maryland, 16 years of age, working in the Washington Post newsroom. Like, he is as East Coast as they get. And in deep inside that, you know, that whole experience. But I love here, Woodward is, you know, he's the glamorized Hollywood version of the real Bob Woodward. But it's like this big, beautiful, strapping throwback of a guy comes in, little bit out of place, much more polite and cordial. But yeah, I think that and he needs to learn that to be more incisive and direct. And so I think both of these guys start to, this is the kind of beginnings, and this is what's so great. It's like the movie sort of saute of these two characters and personalities that start going, look, I'm never going to be you and you're never going to be me, but sometimes I'm going to go, that's good. You know, and I've worked with many writers, or you work with people that you know, different workplaces. And even if it's just someone, you know, you work in a factory and the way they drive a forklift, you're like, man, he does that smart. Like, he goes that way. He puts the prongs up here because it's faster for him to get the forklift. You know, there's just these little touches of effortlessness and things that people do better. And so that's what I love about this minute, because it's so him, but it's also him starting to grow out of that green guy who had no clue Charles Colson was. And it's the guy who's starting to, you know, this is him becoming self-aware and really honing his craft of like, I'm going to ask really incisive and direct questions that are really hard to get out of. Because this is how the story breaks.
And I think in my experiences as a Midwesterner, sometimes all it takes to really connect with someone from a different... for example, I lived in Hollywood when I was in my 20s, and there was this... I'm from Fargo, so people automatically think of the movie Fargo.
Can't help it.
I hadn't seen when I moved there, believe it or not. But sometimes, you know, people just want to know that you're going to stand up for yourself and that here's what I know, or at least I'm trying.
Yeah.
I'm doing my best here, and Woodward is getting there after figuring things out. And I like the tone for All the President's Men, where there's nothing like, you don't have the confident guy chewing on gum or eating snacks to convey that he's the confident guy.
Nah.
Well, Hoffman, you know, there's a little flamboyance, but it's not distracting. You know, he's just the guy that's been around the block. You can pick up on that. He's not a total ass when he
comfort smokes. That's about his nervous tick is smoking a 1,000 cigarettes a day.
You know, I think he's just trying to figure things out in his own way, trying to get up the ladder and
but it's also overcoming cynicism, right? That's the major difference. Is like Woodward can come in pretty fresh, and you know that's Carl's biggest thing, is he's got to overcome the cynicism. Imagine, and I find this hard to imagine myself. Imagine, you know, you and I, passionate film fans, you know, worked in adjacent to this industry, and especially you running a publication as you do. The thing that I think about all the time is like, and I crave talking to the journalists that I've talked to on this show about it, is like, and my best friend particularly, like, she was a prodigious journalist, went into a newsroom at 16 as well. And, you know, she was on the crime beat within a year. And you're like, imagine being 16, 17, going to crime scenes all the day, like being on police beat. Like by the time you hit 30s and 35 and 40, you're like, you've seen some shit. And so I think that even though he's sort of in his 20s here at Bernstein, the character, he's definitely seen some stuff. He's definitely been around the block. And so I think that that's where he can stop immediately seeing conspiratorial things in every single person. He's got to try and find some goodness in the people that are going to give him the information. I think that that's what he absorbs from working with Woodward, or the Woodward that is portrayed in this movie.
Yeah, I think that time, you know, early 70s, now, I mean, I do everything home now, online, and I've never been in the newsroom. Growing up, I always thought about that, especially watching this movie, watching Zodiac, like, and just really getting to the heart of the story. But my reality is that this is what I do now. I work from home, and I think at heart, I'm not, I often get frustrated just from day to, just like everyone else, just trying to get by and do your thing. But I'm really an optimist. I just try to, I think I got this from my parents, you know, just to think about the bigger picture, which I think this movie is all about. Like, what's really, or at least on one level, like, what's really going on?
Yes.
You know, it's not, you know, there's Nixon, but it's also, you know, the final deep throat reveal that Jason just spoke about, or maybe that was the first deep throat scene. But the final deep throat reveal is what? You know, it's FBI, you know, it's everyone, you know, that's the, and in the end, you know, the movie comes to this beautiful place where they get the job done. They're working together and history plays out, but there's still that looming threat. And that's what I grapple with.
I agree.
That's what I grapple with today. Just trying to work trying to figure out how to navigate through everything and what my insecurities about what I haven't done, but still knowing what I can do. And then I'm at least trying, like Woodward, and like Bernstein too, you know, everyone's got their different story. I'm here in Fargo, you're in Australia, but we're working together on this. And, that's what I, you know, from minute one, there's just, I can't remember who on your podcast spoke about this, but about it being a comfort film, you know, there's so many different layers to approach this. The horror of not knowing, like, what the hell's going on and what can happen. But then also knowing that you're within this group and you're within a community. And, some, you know, a lot of people just want to be recognized as being part of a group, which is what Woodward and Bernstein have, you know?
I think that's that great community that these guys find in this newsroom. That's one of the things that I crave when you talk about the comfort. Like, you know, as much of, I don't think there's more alluring a thought for me right now is the prospect of, you know, imagining all of the great people that we know and we talk to and that you interact with on Vague Visages or and that I work with at different publications, just imagining us all getting to work in a newsroom together. Wow. I just imagine just hammering away on a typewriter, you know, having a cigarette. Like I just like, oh, wouldn't it be so good if just like there were little partitions and all of us were just just grinding together in like a big space. Like it would be such a different life, you know, and especially now in isolation as we're recording this, in quarantine to a large extent, and things are starting to open back up. But you know, the very concept of having a whole bunch of people around and you're all working together, or people you can bounce ideas off of that make you better. Like I just, you know, that's where the comfort comes in, especially right now.
And I think that's what the film another thing the film highlights is that. The sense of professionalism,
yeah.
Where these, I think, to your point, you doing what you do in Australia, myself here in Fargo, whoever you are working from home, you learn how to adapt and see what you need to do. And then just like you said, just imagine if we all came to be in the same place. I mean, sure. There'd be a few parties. There'd be a few happy hours gone wrong, maybe. But we'd all have this, and I think that's where we're all headed, to be honest, is that with, you know, my new subscription service, ultimately that's what I want to do is have a staff and have a community, at least at some point in the physical, we're all physically in one spot. You know, some people would work remotely, but I think what we're all doing now is, especially now through COVID-19, learning more about yourself, learning more about your process. I mean, you're working harder than ever, I'm sure. I've been doing the same routine pretty much, just grinding, you know?
Yeah.
Once you get that break, whether it's you moving, or maybe you want to stay in Australia, maybe you want to move, but whatever it is, let's stop there. What do you want to do moving forward?
That's a question I haven't been asked on this show. Look, I don't know about moving. Moving scares me. Out of Australia or out of New Zealand right now, the prospect of moving to the States scares me. One. Two, family. I can tell you on this show, because it'll be recorded, it's recorded after. Yesterday, I actually went and got a COVID-19 test. Like, I went and got one because I was feeling a little bit run down, as you can imagine. I have been working harder than ever on a couple of these upcoming projects, and I was like, oh, I should do the due diligence. In Oz, they're like, if you feel sick, you should just go get tested to make sure that you don't have it. So I went and got the test. Fortunately, negative. Hilarious, which is excellent.
Good news.
Very, very good news. Got a text message on the registration service. Sir, your results are negative. Well done. I'm like, yes. I went and hugged my kids. I went and hugged my kids. I went and hugged my wife. It was exciting because you have to isolate after your test just in case you have it. And I don't know. But I definitely, when I imagine like, you know, a scenario of what my favorite thing in the world could possibly be, I think about this scenario. I think about like, wouldn't it be amazing to work with the great people that you love working with, to produce content and art and things for people in such a way that it was consumable and people wanted to do it? And also, I still fantasize about, like, it's not just like having the, you know, working from home aspect and doing that sort of stuff. I still fantasize about the prospect of having a team. Like of working with a team of people doing this, because I just know what it's like when you work on it, you know, whether it's a sporting team or whether it's anything, it's like, if you work with really great people, they just push you. And I think every single person in the whole world has probably watched The Last Dance to this point. You think all those players got good because they played with each other or because they played with Jordan, you know, like I think right. sometimes
you need someone to push you.
Sometimes, yeah, you need all sorts. And so I fantasize about this idea of being like, you know, imagine the murderer's row lineup you could have of some of the great film writers that you and I have both worked with and being like, wow, we've just got this amazing murderer's row of people that are all around us and you get to watch them work and you get to shoot the breeze with them and you're like, shit, that's a really good, you know, way of thinking about something. I had a problem in what I was working on, but if I apply that lens to it, maybe it'll come to life. And it's just, you know, you hear about it with comedians talking about it. All those sorts of things. Comedians talking about, how like they go up at a comedy store, they do a bit, then one of their colleagues will help them tag it up and, you know, laugh at it if it's great or say, I love this bit. And there's just those sorts of things that you like, you imagine in those teams that could be amazing. You're like, whoa, that could be the dream. That is the dream, but it's just like what that looks like now in post COVID time is different, but it's always something I've always thought about. It's, you know, it's and envious of places like The Ringer and things like that, for their amazing cohort of great people that work together and do podcasts and write about things that are cool and those sorts of things. They seem to have sort of nailed it. But yeah, I guess that, you know, talking about a dream, it would be like that, like having a space, fun content, but just great people pushing each other to write really great stuff and produce really great stuff.
Yeah, I brought up traveling because I've had the best times of my life traveling, and it's been a few years. Since 2012, since I've been here in Fargo, I haven't really gone anywhere, to be honest. I've been to see family in Vegas and Phoenix and went to California once, but when I was younger, like, my life changed when I went took a Euro trip, or when I took another trip to Italy. Meanwhile, I was living in Hollywood, California, just blocks from where The Ringer is now. I'm like, now it would just be ideal to live blocks from like a place like The Ringer or whoever.
Yeah.
Just to be in closer proximity to that opportunity. I can still pitch from afar, of course, but
yes.
I do love traveling. It's my dream to take the website around the world and to meet all the different writers, come down to Australia, go
you're welcome
wherever.
You've got a tour guide if you ever come to Sydney.
Yeah, man, I would love that. Are we still talking?
I think this is a good place. I think this is a good place to wrap up, because I think that right now we can plan your next trip to Sydney. But QV, look, I cherish talking to you because you at least ask questions sometimes that I haven't been able to confess myself, and that's part of every great podcast. And I love being able to imagine that ethos of a Midwestern guy who wears a pencil in his ear. That's such a, you know, I think, you know, different people in his life in Oz, and I've got friends who are like that. I've got myself who's like that. Sometimes I wear a pencil in my ear when I'm pottering around the house doing things, and people are like, why you got that there? And I'm just like, just in case, it's all right. Just in case I have an idea or I think of something, I need to scribble it down. So I've loved having you to chat about this, and just look, thank you so much. I might let you say better than anyone else everything about Vague Visages and everything that's going on there, because you know, it's all happening. So do you want to give a shout out to the folks who are listening about everything that's happening with Vague Visages going forward?
Yeah, well, I just have 3 monthly subscription plans. I have a monthly at $2.99 per month. I have a quarterly plan, $2 a month, which is $5.99 every 3 months, and I have a yearly plan at $11.99 US per month, which is $1 a month. So whatever you can do, just I urge you to check out the site, see what you're doing, and if you like what you read, like what you see, hopefully you can support us. And regardless, I appreciate the opportunity to be on this podcast, and I appreciate everyone paying attention to my little film site from Fargo. It means a lot. So thank you, Blake.
Thank you, mate.
Thank you too.
Thank you for being a part of the show. Thank everyone for listening, and I just want to say a huge thank you to again for your time.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
That was the incredible and lovely QV Haug, which you can find on Twitter at QVHOUGH, and you can go to his great site, Vague Visages, or Vague Visages, which is VAGUEVISAGES.com. And it is now a subscription service, but it literally has an incredible array of film writing, of music writing, long and thoughtful essays, terrific writers outside of myself that you should check out. So please do that. If you want to support One Heat Meter Productions, the very best thing that you can do right from the start is share and like and tell people about the show. If you're having a good time listening, please share and share a like on any of your socials. We'd really, really appreciate it. If you know anyone that is, you know, someone who's keen to listen or someone that you think will like the show, send them a text with a link. We're available on basically every single podcast service. Oneheatminute.com is where you can find us. You can find everything about the show. And at ATPM Pod on Twitter. We'll catch you on another episode of All the President's Minutes very soon.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.